Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hello, and welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 45. So, really quickly, I'll be performing stand-up comedy at the Addison Improv in Addison, Texas, just outside of Dallas, Thursday through Saturday, November 18 through 20. That is all. And now for the podcast, episode number 45, with Mr. Kevin Pollack. I thank you.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast. I am Chris Hardwick. Sitting to my left is Matthew Myra. Jonah Ray is out working on a television program and couldn't be here today. We are at the lovely chateau of Mr. Kevin Pollack.
Hello.
Kevin Pollack. It's a compound.
It's a compound. It is the Kevin Pollack compound. And just a little backstory before we delve into the action here. Kevin Pollack was actually podcasted here a couple weeks ago. What? You're saying? I didn't hear that. No, and you never will.
Why is that?
Well, Kevin, you were nice enough to come to Comcast a couple weeks ago and donate a couple hours of your time.
I'll say.
I lost the Zoom H4n recorder that day.
Yeah.
And so when you showed up, it was like a last minute thing. Like, well, I can't find the recorder. I don't know what to do. I know what we'll do. I've been recording sets on my iPhone voice memo thing. Let's just do it on that. How bad could it be? The answer is horrible.
Yeah.
I had propped the phone up against a telephone system.
Yes,
and
you
so
did.
there was a little bit of electrical interference throughout most of the podcast.
A wee bit.
Just a touch. Uh-huh. And not only that, but it was a day of blunders on
yes,
my part.
Yes, it really was. I didn't want to say anything.
I know.
Let's air this out. Let's air this out.
So we're going to air this out. We're in a conference room. Some people from a program called E! True Hollywood Stories decided to lay claim to the conference room.
That they had for 4 years.
Well, at first it was, this has been our conference room for 4 years. And we were like, really? And they go, well, no, actually it's more like two. So right off the bat, they were exaggerating their argument to try to establish superiority.
Sure.
Impressively so.
Impressively so. Yeah. So I dropped your name, which worked very well. I said, oh, well, I'm interviewing Kevin Pollack in here and we reserved this room.
Kevin, like, graciously, he walked up.
Yes. And they scattered like cockroaches. Now, what I found out later was that they were, in fact, wrong. In the Comcast building...
I thought you were going to say, what I found out later was they were, in fact, cockroaches. No.
It was the metamorphosis.
Yeah.
Gregor Samsa woke to find himself in the form of a hideous vermin.
Oh.
And then he worked for E! True Hollywood Stories. But every 4 months you're supposed to renew your claim on a conference room.
I think everyone knows
that. Yes, and they did not. So they were wrong.
Yes.
We were right. And it didn't matter. It was all a waste of time because the podcast was unusable. So I had to make the sheepish phone call to Kevin Pollack, Matthew Myra.
Yes.
And I said, Kevin, I'm really sorry. There was a problem, as you can guess. Please, will you please come on the podcast again? You were like, yes. I mean, like, you were so nice about it right away. And thank you.
Oh, please. It was a chance to show off my new house.
Which is gorgeous, by the way.
We just moved in literally within days. Boxes are just broken down and piled. It took... I was kind of surprised because when you fill 30 boxes, when you move them in, you think, well, these will never get unpacked.
Right.
Ever.
Yeah.
And they're in every room. And I just want to pat Milady on the back for doing a phenomenal job in 3 days of getting the hell out of the boxes.
I would not know you moved in 3 days ago.
I wouldn't either. And by the way, we're in your dining room right now, and let me just give you a...
grand dining room.
Let me give you a little bit of a tour of what's in this room. On one side, there is a Haunted Mansion scotch set.
Sure.
Which is awesome. It's got the Haunted Mansion on it, and it's got, like, each of the glasses have different ghouls, like 60s-style ghouls.
Better believe it.
There's some type of...
bottle from the 60s.
A bottle from the 60s in the shape of a fancy fox with a top hat.
Well, he's obviously just gone hunting.
Listen, the only for his own kind, because he's a cannibal.
Sure.
Or he's sold out. He's a bitch sellout. He's the Uncle Tom of foxes. Mm. I would only say that he would only be fancier if he were using his own tail as a stole, but he's not. Then over here, you have what looks like something from the set of Boardwalk Empire,
uh-huh.
which is awesome. Would you like to explain this piece of
equipment? Oh, it's just a barber chair from the 20s.
It's gorgeous!
It's all wood and old metal and the original fabric. And yeah, I mean, I don't know how well it plays in the audio version of my description, but...
In the mind's eye, yeah. It's gorgeous.
And what else would you do with a barber's chair but put a skeleton sitting in it?
Now, I noticed, because there's also an anatomy poster over there of a skeleton.
Uh-huh.
Are you a skeleton fetishist of some sort?
My sweet better half loves the morbid.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and I have easily said, hey, that looks cool.
You've got to hang on to a lady when she's with the morbid side.
Yeah. Yeah, there she is now.
Hey, we're talking about your awesome skeletons.
He was just going through the Haunted Mansion scotch set.
I got the stretching gallery paintings. I just got them yesterday, and I took them to the framework, and they're going in that hallway.
Oh, I told them.
Awesome. So you actually have the stretchy paintings from the Haunted Mansion.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
Well, print. You can buy the prints at Disneyland. Yeah, I got the prints and I just dropped them off at the frame yesterday.
I shared that with him before we started the podcast, and he was kind enough to point out that Rob Zombie has one of the originals.
It's got the roller marks on it.
It's got the roller marks on it.
But he's only got one, so your four are better than his one.
And ours will be framed and spotlit.
That's awesome. And then as people are walking down the hallway, you're going to have the recording of, is this room actually a scotch?
She has it
on her iPod.
I should put it on the doorbell.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that'd be awesome.
That is fantastic. That's fantastic. Well done. We are big fans of your house and what you've done.
They're digging the macabre.
I'm going to go work some more.
Yeah.
All right. Time to move in and get settled.
You know what I'm saying?
You're going to put headstones in the backyard?
Ooh, nice. Huh? I think that's a quick yes.
I heard a reaction from the other room. Yeah.
To find a way out.
Of course, there's always my way.
Terrifying hanging woman.
Can you afford to pay the residuals on that?
We got it. We actually own it. It's weird.
I always love when the lights are when it's still dark and then skeleton in the haunted mansion above the room. There's always some piece of shit frat guy who has to yell out like, "Oh fuck!" Like just when there's kids there, just to be a jerk.
Yeah.
Wait, that might have been me.
It's a terror. I don't know why that didn't affect me more as a child, but. The image of the hanging woman.
My way out.
The visage of the woman just killing herself in front of a family.
It's interesting that you said woman, because the voiceover clearly states...
Is that? I thought it was a woman.
You could always try my way.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, well, but I'm fairly certain.
Because of the long
Master
hair?
Master Gracie, the owner of the house.
The what?
It's Master Gracie, the owner of the
Master
house.
Master Gracie, the owner of the house.
Fair
well
enough.
Done.
I always thought it was a woman.
It could be a woman.
What does that say about
so
me?
So the podcast is entertaining and educational.
It is educational. Right. That's fantastic. Because I mean, I have an annual pass to Disneyland, and we go down.
Who doesn't?
We can.
Well, I have the annual, but Milady, of course, has the premium.
Oh, no blackout dates for her.
No blackout dates, and it's like the Black American Express card.
Oh my God,
it's crazy.
P.S. Oh no, keep going.
It has what would you call it? Weight. And
it's like metallic.
Is it made of metal like
it's
the black
of
card?
Some other product than the ones we have.
It's made of the original. It's a Small World, right?
And it's also a hologram of Walt. He pops up. If he's positioned just so, he pops up and says, "I don't like blacks and Jews."
But please enjoy my movie.
He goes back down to the car.
It's odd that that's all they had him record.
I said this on the podcast before that I heard that Walt Disney commission someone to create his signature. Like, that famous Walt Disney signature was actually commissioned by an artist.
Genius.
You said that in conversation. I don't know if you said it on the podcast.
Yeah, that was a story that I heard once.
Right on.
Also, P.S., how do I get a fucking Black American Express card? I know there are real problems going on in the world, Kevin Pollak. There's famine and hunger.
I think you have to spend on average $100,000 a year with the card.
But even so, like...
Yeah,
like,
and then there's a premium, which is not the crazy $25,000 premium everyone says it is. It's like...
Oh, it's not that bad.
No, it's like $2,500 or $5,000.
I want that sweet Black American Express card. If you're listening on You Work for American Express, give me my black card for no reason that I can think of. Let's talk about...
What would be the first thing...
It's made of metal, though.
Would you technically impress?
I would take it to McDonald's.
Sales clerks.
Bingo.
I would take
it. Like, this ain't a real card.
No, we have a winner.
I would wear it. I would wear it on a chain around my neck.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, I went out to lunch with Corolla once, and he threw one of those things down. I was like, "What's that?" Nah, I don't know. Kimmel hooked me up with it. I'm like, all right, fuck, come on. What are you holding that for? Is it a good Corolla?
Apparently, you need to talk to Kimmel.
We think we need to talk to Kimmel. Yeah,
clearly.
Before we get into the Kevin Pollakness of the podcast, I would first like to state that there has been a small podcast tragedy.
A crime against the Nerdist.
A crime against the Nerdist in that...
You think you were targeted?
I feel like we might have been
a rival podcast.
Maybe we were targeted by Running Your Trap or Jimmy Pardo.
Belknap.
Belknap. last week I gave Matthew the suitcase that had all of the podcasting equipment.
On Wednesday.
The suitcase. Shouldn't you call it the football at this point?
At this point, yes. Because who knows what
I was entrusted with the
I get a call the next morning. Matthew's sheepish call. It's all gone. What? All the podcasting equipment's gone. Someone broke into my car.
You were literally the first call I made was to you.
Not to the insurance?
Nope.
You don't think that'll look suspicious to the cops?
Because I felt like...
It says there you
go. When they go over your phone records after
a friend and benefactor first.
That's right. So someone broke into Matthew's car, his Honda, and rifled through the suitcase.
Civic Hybrid, everybody. It's not like a Honda.
They rifled through. They just basically took the... They left all the cords and the pee poppers and the stands.
They took the microphones, the mixer board, three pairs of jeans from Big and Tall that were too big for me. That I was going to return. So I don't know what they're going to do with that. Perhaps build a tent city.
Well, those Big and Tall jeans are worth... The board didn't work. Two of the microphones were broken. So fuck you guys. You took a lot of broken equipment, you fucking losers.
And my jeans. Now I'm wearing shorts, guys. And I'm going back to Massachusetts for like a weekend and now I'm going to have to wear shorts.
Here's the sad part. Matthew, they broke his ignition lock to steal the car.
That's always the worst.
Stuck a screwdriver in there.
And Matthew's driveway is very narrow to get back behind his apartment building, and the wheels were turned a little bit.
Oh, no.
Yeah, they were locked. So the tow truck driver came, and it's just he and I trying to get this thing out.
You had to put it on a flatbed?
We had to put it on these little coasters to get it out of the driveway, because you could not get a tow truck back there.
The Haunted Mansion coasters?
The Haunted Mansion coasters. set of five. And I don't know what the fifth one was for, but we put them on. And he's telling me to push, so to angle the car out of the driveway. It's very tight, and I'm pushing. Mm. Don't know my own strength. And much like Edward in Twilight, I pushed into my quarter panel on the front, dented it.
I'll say.
And then the...
if you ever say much like Edward in Twilight again, you will never be allowed back on this podcast.
Just wait. then the tow truck driver's like, oh, don't worry, they fix. And then he goes to open my door, and it's not opening because the quarter panel's now dented, and he just rips it, and it makes it far worse than it was. And now I have to file a separate claim and pay a separate deductible to get that fixed.
Yeah, nice job, Progressive Insurance. I'm going to tell Stephanie Courtney to put that in the commercials.
Yeah, Flo, come on.
They're making him file a separate claim for the damage to try to from towing his car. He has to pay another deductible.
And when he tried to get the hooks underneath the car, the front end started to come off.
Wow.
Yeah.
Love fest.
So anyway, I get to pay another deductible.
Meanwhile, are you mic'd by a lav?
He's mic'd by this thing.
Look at that.
I got two microphones. Deal with that.
All right.
So now your car looks like it was act two of horrible. The accused.
It's horrible. I drove by it last night to see if they'd done anything with it. It hasn't moved.
Is it totaled?
No, it can't be totaled. It's just front end damage,
to be totaled.
I would love it if they were successful in stealing my vehicle at this point.
Right. See, that's the rub, isn't it? Why half-ass it?
Why not take it?
If you're gonna put a bomb in your shoe, don't you know? Go in the toilet and
you're
light
break
it. Don't
my...
try to light it at your seat.
You're gonna go to Comedy Death Ray Radio and be like, "Hey, Scott Aukerman, where'd you get those jeans and those fancy mics?" I don't know.
Why are there four of you in those
Bottom
jeans?
Bottom on the black market.
So let's shift some focus back to our
kind guest. No, that's why you're wrong.
Okay.
If you have any information, please email stuff at nerdist.com.
Swear word. So Kevin
Pollak. My fucking car.
My fucking car. Kevin Pollak, I have a long time been a fan of yours because when I originally saw A Few Good Men, it occurred to me like, oh, as a comedian, you can also do roles where you don't have to be a funny person. Like, you can do serious roles. Like, for some reason in my mind, I hadn't put those two things together yet, because I was still like, comedians do comedy roles.
Yeah.
And so, what was the process like for that movie? Were they a fan of your comedy? Did you audition for it?
I also had that moment early on when I was a stand-up in San Francisco and Paul Reiser was in the Barry Levinson movie Diner.
Yes.
And the same thing happened for me. It was like, oh, right, of course. He's similar in age, and he was hilarious in the film, but he was real, and it was a dramedy, as it were. So I can appreciate from whence you came. In my situation with A Few Good Men, I was doing a six-episode summer series back when there was no real original programming during the summer. 1991, I'll have you know. For Rob Reiner and Christopher Guest, there I said them names. And they had created this really funny thing. It was the show was... it was really kind of a hybrid weird thing, and on CBS Y. But
CBS Youth?
It was called Morton and Hayes. And at the beginning of the show, Rob Reiner appears sitting in a den talking to camera.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, I'm Rob Reiner. You may know me from All in the Family or directing motion pictures, but what you may not know is that I've always been a fan of the comedy teams of the 20s and the 30s. Abbott and Costello, Laurel and Hardy, and the great Chick Morton and Eddie Hayes. Recently, while construction workers were tearing down a Foster Freeze to make room for a Dairy Queen, or vice versa, they uncovered a vault filled with old two-reelers of the great Morton and Hayes. We've dusted them off and will present one to you each week. And then he leans over to a projector and says, "Enjoy this week's two-reeler, Saps at Sea." And he hits a switch, and the light from the projector fills the screen, and then a black and white two-reeler unfolds, as if shot in the 30s, with me and this heavyset guy, great actor Bob Amaral, as Chick Morton and Eddie Hayes. And I'm a little wisecracking Chick Morton. What's the matter with you, Eddie? You know, that guy.
Yeah.
So while we're shooting that, and like I said, Chris Guest was behind the creation, and Michael McKean did a bunch, and Chris Guest directed some, and it was ridiculously great and a crazy audition process to get that part. But while I was shooting that, I'm having lunch every day with Rob. And one day, he waves his stubby finger in my face and says, albeit quite talented, stubby finger, and says, you know, I am directing this next movie. It was a Broadway play called A Few Good Men. And I got Tom Cruise, and I think we're going to get Nicholson to play the crazy colonel. And anyways, there's this part of Tom's co-counsel that you're kind of perfect for. I've got an offer out to Jason Alexander, but if Seinfeld gets picked up for a second season, he won't be available. And I instantly started praying for Seinfeld's success. I had Jason Alexander.
They almost didn't, by the way. The first season of Seinfeld,
dude,
I don't know if people remember this, it did not go well.
The Seinfeld Chronicles.
I just had Jason Alexander on my Kevin Pollak's Chat Show podcast deal. And,
a fine chat show program.
Grilled him extensively about it. And the pilot, turns out, was Seinfeld Chronicles. The first season was 4 episodes called Seinfeld. At that point, they'd lost the Chronicles, which I didn't remember. And those 4 episodes were not on Thursday Night After Cheers. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until the second year when they got bumped to Thursday Night After Cheers that they had any sort of... And by the way, I asked him, well, when you get the news... You know, you're going for a second season, which of course made my career and allowed me to do A Few Good Men. But for the cast, I said, this must have been amazing news that you're going to follow the best show, the best time slot. And he said, no, actually the opposite. We thought that would be the end. Who the hell would watch Cheers and then us?
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to understand, you know, in terms of adding a little perspective here, the test results were horrible. The network didn't like us. There was one guy in late night who had made the deal with Jerry, and that's the only reason we were there. And, you know, we had no chance. And then to move us to a great time slot like that, it's like the lemmings going off the cliff. The ratings would have to die, you know. So, anyway.
I don't know if I could picture him in your role.
Well, you know, he had done Pretty Woman prior, and he had, of course, had a huge Broadway career.
He was so mean to that prostitute.
Yes, he really was.
I'm so glad that Richard Unfairly. Punched him. Unfairly. He was just not a nice guy.
Yeah. So that's how that A Few Good Men came my way. And then, you know, that was really, the rest of the cast were pretty wildly famous, even in smaller roles. Kiefer Sutherland a very young Noah Wiley.
Oh yeah,
had one scene on The Stand. And
did you ever see the Ben Stiller show parody of it, A Few Good Scouts?
Oh, of course.
Where Andy Dick plays the Kiefer Sutherland, but he's just speaking like a gibberish, like, he had no cold, but he had no, you're saying Santiago had no cold in a menorah? You're saying he was Jewish? I don't think so. Like, it was like, he was so mealy mouth. Like,
no, that's brilliant.
But yeah, so what is that? I mean, like, at this point, how long have you been doing stand-up comedy in 91?
I turned pro in maybe 80, so 11 years.
So at that point, is it like, wow, this might be taking me to the next level, or is your...
Oh, it was the keys to the castle.
Okay, so you weren't so kind of worn down after 11 years of nonstop stand-up that you were jaded about it.
No. Oh, no. I was like a 7-year-old on Christmas morning every day on the set. I mean, you could feel what this was. It was a huge Broadway success, A Few Good Men. Gigantic. And everyone was sort of at the height of their game in terms of the director and the cast, and it was a Nicholson. I mean, in 1991, I guess there hadn't been a lot of movies where you had that many stars all in one film.
Mm-hmm. Mad World.
Other than, of course, that classic, which does not hold up.
Just in case you're
wondering. But for me, I was the only Discovery actor. Where the audience was, who's this guy? I know everybody else. I've got the playbook, or you know. So it was really that moment of that. I guess actors, the goal line of you cross this and you get offers instead of having to audition. Nice. That all happened within 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah. Of getting shooting the movie and then it comes out and then it's just an instant. Huge hit, and it was, you know, it was getting offers all of a sudden, which was weird because I was still a character actor. Nobody was going to plunk down money to this day to see. You don't want me number one on your call sheet. But as a character actor, which is all I kind of fantasized about, you know, it was instant nirvana. It was like, so and so call. I want you to be, you know. So
did it feel like all the times, you know, those 11 years and you're doing stand-up, you're like, someday, man, they're gonna be calling me. Like, did it feel that way to you when it was actually happening? Or
I only thought of the first potential representative, a manager, not an agent, when I first got to LA from San Francisco, who I read for to possibly represent me. I'd been in town 3-4 months. Somebody said, well, this woman is a manager, you should. So I go in to her high rise on Wilshire apartment, and she had me read a couple of scenes. Afterwards, she said,
it's not awkward.
The acting is not for everyone. First of all, the acting.
So you mean in general? You mean yes, it's not a career everyone should pursue, or do you mean me specifically?
When you say everyone,
that's an awful thing to say to someone.
Yeah, it really was shattering. So that's all I thought of was that conversation when A Few Good Men was a hit and I was getting offers. I just thought of her, and then I realized, you know what? That was 91, anyway, that was like 7 years after I moved to Los Angeles from San Francisco. And those 7 years, she had kind of fueled me. That experience had kind of, because when I came here, I had no formal training as an actor. I'm not terribly proud of that, but it just happens to be true. And I came from stand-up comedy, and from so many years of being on stage and suffering wildly from, hey, look at me disease, I was ridiculously comfortable in front of an audience, and it just translated to ridiculously comfortable in front of the camera. And that's all I had and have, is this ease in front of the lens. That's it. That's all I can bring. And then on A Few Good Men, I got to work with this brilliant character actor, J.T. Walsh.
Yes. Oh, my God. Insane.
Yeah. Nutty, nutty, nutty brilliant. And he was watching me one day, and he was this great subversive guy, may he rest in peace, and he said to me, you know, what you're doing is an actual method of acting. I said, because I had to confess to him that I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. And he said, no, there's an actual method, which is less is more. And by doing less, because I just kept underplaying it, just make it more real, less anything. And he said, less is more, and then the second half of that is nothing is best. Less is more, nothing is best. If you can actually do nothing in a scene, literally nothing, trust me, people's eyes will drift to you. What the fuck? That guy's not doing anything?
Boy, I wish I know how to do that. I can't shut my brain off long enough and be like, I am aware of what I am doing and saying these lines.
Well, to this day, actually, after the third take, that's what is going on in my head. We're doing another one? Really? All I'm hearing is myself act.
Yeah. J.T. Walsh was so fucking awesome in The Big Picture.
Oh, shit.
Do you like thimbles, Nick? Like, he...
Yes.
That guy is insane. I mean, yeah. he was so...
The grifters, you should...
Oh, the grifters. Oh,
He was a great grifter who
like
turned...
Like, this quiet, magnetic dude.
Yeah. Well, nothing is best.
Nothing is best.
And then when he lost his shit, it was so... anyways, so that was the big coming out party for me, and...
How do you navigate that?
Also, by the way, it happened at 91, 92, the film came out, which, as you remember, was the death of stand-up comedy.
Right around the bursting of the comedy bubble.
It was. The golden age of the mid to late 80s had literally met its end as I was getting offers to be in movies. So to drift away from stand-up was...
Good timing.
...as organic as possible.
Yeah.
And I stopped touring completely for almost 9 years. And during which time I did a lot of movies. I don't know the exact number. 41.
Give or take zero.
Five of them, by the way, really good.
So here's what I want to ask you is that when you... Because so much goes... In, you know, like when people...
How do you navigate?
How do you know... Like, when everyone's telling you, you're great!
Yeah.
And you lose your sort of barometer for, you know, what's good and what's not good, and people are offering you more things than you know how to handle. How do you pick the right thing? I mean, do you ever really know, or is there's always a little bit of a crapshoot involved? I feel like success can be just as detrimental, theoretically, as, you know, like never succeeding, because, you know, it's just a different strategy.
With success, you have money.
You do have money, but just sitting on a pile of money won't make you happy for the rest of your life.
As it turns out, it won't. I'll tell you, there's no correct path, mm-hmm. and there's no way to avoid doing what ends up to be bad work.
Mm-hmm.
And by bad work, I mean the product is bad.
Well, you just don't know because it depends on the director. It actually depends on lighting, cinematography. You don't know how the film's going to be edited. They can make you look anyway.
Yeah, the editing is the final rewrite. And performances are made and killed in editing. And I'm not pointing fingers and I'm not placing blame. But I, to this day, with all this inventory, as I like to call it, otherwise known as a filmography, there isn't one that I read and said yes to that I knew was going to be crap, mm-hmm. and just did it for the money.
Mm-hmm.
There are several that turned out to be absolute crap, and the script, when I read it, was good.
And at what...
They weren't always great, but they were at least good, mm-hmm. you know?
At what point, when you're making a movie that it turns out to be not great, do you realize that this is not going to be great?
Oh, every point.
I mean, but you read the script is okay. Is it when you get on set?
Yeah, no, it's not the moment you walk on set.
And you're like, shit.
Although there was one.
It's going to be terrible.
Juana Man, I will point to instantly. just by the title.
I don't want to say any names, but
I don't want to point any exact fingers. But there was a situation where I was cast, and they had Will Smith as the lead, who ultimately was not in the movie. And so when I walked on the set, it was, oh, I see, we're going with a lesser known Will Smith.
I need to go out for cigarettes. Forever.
Forever, yeah. So there was a script that read funny, and then less Will Smith.
Do you want a man read funny?
Not as funny. Well, when you pictured Will Smith saying those words, guess what?
Okay. You know what, though? Honestly, I see this happen, you know.
Not funny now.
Obviously, the turnover rate in television is much higher than film, but I've seen it happen where you read a script that is fucking brilliant that a network's going to do, and by the time all the network people get their hands on it, and you see what started out as in a script as a really smart, you know, single camera sitcom turns into a three camera laugh track sitcom with jokes.
On the day, you know, when you're shooting the scene, someone decides. You remember another thing when it was real subtle, and I always point to that great moment in Spinal Tap when one scene they all show up and they have these giant cold sores on different places on their mouth, right? But it's never mentioned.
Right.
It's never mentioned. It's never pointed to. No one even winks at it or looks at each other with a question mark. It just is.
Mm-hmm.
So when you read that in the script, it's great, and it's never executed that well. Somewhere along the line, somebody says, somebody needs to roll their eyes at least.
Right.
And then that becomes a gesture, and then that becomes, you're right. What you mean? Well, you've got something on your face. We all do, idiot. You know, it at least becomes that.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyways, so.
Well, I always, and another version of that is, if you watch Python or any early Zucker Brothers stuff, and you see insane shit going on in the background.
Oh, man.
I always imagine that a network would probably be like, we need to get a single of that craziness in the background and let people see what's fucking going on. But, you know, like, the fact that it's in the background makes it a million times funnier that they don't they don't focus on it.
Yeah. It's that wonderful outer-edged comic going on the page of Mad Magazine.
Sergio Aragonés.
There you go.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. So you... Cool.
So that was the transition, and then all those movies happened.
Well, I haven't. Were you in Willow?
Yes, sir.
You were with Rick Overton.
Yes, sir.
You played the
little brownies.
You were the little brownies.
Shall I recreate the moment?
Yes.
A moment?
I think you have to.
Is he here? Loud. May we speak with him?
You want to make an adjustment?
No.
I'm like, this way! No, this way! Thank you. Please be seated. Far too ridiculous and kind.
When my father sat me on his knee, he said, son, someday something will happen that will change the course of your natural life. I loved that movie.
Yeah, it was pretty...
Did you work with the rest of the actors? Were you in Overton? Like
Rick and I were in post-production of the largest green screen facility in the world. Yes, before blue screen. Well, I guess it was blue screen first. I've lost count.
You must have started... You and Rick must have done Stand Up Together in San Francisco.
I'm unbelievably grateful, and I had Rick on the show too and thanked him in front of cameras, which I hadn't done before, and it felt pretty good. But he had worked with Ron Howard before in Gung Ho and a couple of other movies, I think, and so Ron cast him as one of the brownies and then said, I really need you to pair with someone you can improvise with. Can you pick like four guys? We'll bring him in, have him do the scene a couple of times, improvise with him. And then so Rick put me on that list of four guys because we had done stand-up together at various shows. So I thank him. Literally, that led to, you know, other opportunities in a huge way, and the two of us jumped around it was like Land of the Giants stuff. They had these big ship built
because right.
we were in somebody's satchel or we were hiding behind a rock.
A giant Val Kilmer.
Yeah, so they shot the film in Wales and New Zealand, and we were in the South States in Samarfa. And then because we were also in post production, Ron Howard would yell at us. When he was directing, there's a horse. That's a horse's tail right there. He's swinging by. Look, okay, you guys duck. And that's I thought. Well, this is a strange way of acting. Yes,
this is gonna cut together, okay? Right?
Yeah.
Right, Ron Howard.
Because we're talking and you're yelling over at the same time. One day Ron had we've shot that for 5 weeks, all our stuff in 5 weeks because it was just us. And one day Ron had a family thing, and so George Lucas, who produced the film and of course owned the blue screen facility we were shooting at up at Lucas Ranch.
Of course he did.
Stopped in to direct.
Ooh.
And instead of yelling, he was, okay, well, I guess cut.
Now, see, that feels like that feels like a girl's dating a dude, and he's like, hey, why don't you blow one of my friends? Like, that's weird to have another director come in, and you're like, oh okay, well, I mean, he's a famous guy, sure. I don't know if people really understand. I mean, I know in the comedy community, people know Rick Overton, and, you know, like, he may not be a household name as far as comics go, but I don't know if people realize how influential that guy was on so many other comics.
Oh, yeah.
Who came after him.
Yes.
You know, because Rick probably started mid-70s, maybe 75, 76?
Yeah, in New York, it was 77-ish.
I would say that there are some very famous comedians who owe a lot to Rick's material. Robin Williams!
Yeah.
But you know, that whole San Francisco crew of Jeremy Kramer and Dana Carvey and like Bobby Slayton.
Yeah.
I mean, what a fucking great time. So what is San Francisco comedy like in, you know, like 81?
Late '70s. Late '70s. I started there in the late '70s, and because I'm 102. it was Robin, when I got, I was born in San Francisco, and then very young, the family moved down to the promise of the suburbs an hour south to San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
The very famous now. And then I moved back to San Francisco when I was 20 to pursue stand-up comedy full-time. So I'd been doing stand-up in San Jose where there were no comedy clubs. I would go on during the band break.
Oh my God, you guys, we're in a bizarre paranormal situation. Whoa, that seems to be coming from the 310 area code.
Oh, he is a master on that theremin.
He really... You're either friends with Death or Brian Wilson.
Hilarious.
Well, it could be both.
One of the same. One
Brian
of the same.
Wilson might be the angel of death.
It was comedy in San Jose. It was opening up, going on during the band's break at a rock and roll bar.
Well, if people know anything, it's that people who go to see musicians love to watch comedy in a bar. They love it more than anything.
Yeah, when the band finally takes a break.
Yeah.
After they've been rocking the house.
They love a comic to take it down nine notches.
Someone please just start talking.
someone point out the crazy foibles of humanity while I'm drunk and watching a band.
Or while I'm trying to pick up on girls because they can finally hear me talk, the band's been playing.
Right.
That's really what was going on.
Okay.
It was the girl's opportunity to get a free drink and the guy's opportunities to make a move.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, hey, quiet over there. You.
But I gotta say, that must have been an insane training ground.
It was. The other version you hear from guys who started out way, I guess, around the same time, a little before me, actually in strip clubs. They would go on, they would MC in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the 60s and in the 70s that was going on. So anyways, when I moved to San Francisco when I was 20, it was... A comedy club? Wait a minute, where people... That's just what's going on? Nothing else? I heard tell.
Someone decided to corral it into its own thing?
And other comedians who know each other and hang out?
It's too good to be true.
Yeah, so it was one of those deals. Like, I was in a farm league, and I came to the... Got brought up to the majors kind of thing. And Robin Williams had been from San Francisco and had just left to do Morgan Mindy, and mm-hmm. so he was an overnight sensation on a giant scale. And so Dana Carvey was it when I got to San Francisco around 78. And so we became friends. And then Slayton. And then the graduating class behind us, really, with Robbie Schneider and Jake Johansson and Paula Poundstone, mm-hmm. Ellen DeGeneres, and huge hitters. So, you know, and they were right on our heels. So there was a good 7-8 years where it was... The very definition of hotbed.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was that incredible community that you hear tell of, you know, and to be in the middle of that, even though at that point I was just doing impersonations, I had no voice of my own per se,
mm-hmm.
although I from the beginning refused to be like my predecessors who said, what if Marlon Brando were a busboy, it might go something like this. I always had to give them some kind of story, you know? like one of my early stand-up specials on the cable there was, the big scene was, of course I did Shatner, and so all the...
Before it was a cool thing to do, I might add.
What, Shatner?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the other bizarre thing about doing impersonations, is when people say, well, you know, everyone's doing you doing so-and-so.
Everyone is.
Right.
And you know, you, first of all, I'm stealing the magic feelings people have towards Shatner.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be clear. You know? And you, there's no owning anything.
Right.
In terms of that bag of tricks of the doing impersonations. So anyway, so I would start off, Captain Plum, start 8, 5, 6, 7, 8.2. Since passing through a cosmic cloud, my crew is acting differently. The personalities have changed. I've got to get to the bottom of it. And then I would call on Spock, and he would be Reverend Jim from Taxi.
Right.
And then I would go down to the engine room, and Scotty is a drunk Arthur Dudley Moore. You know
right.
what I mean? So it was always a scene.
So you're making a scene.
I had to have something, and instead of just turning around and, oh, it's the same guy.
Well, yeah, that's an old, like, I remember one of, I think it was Dennis Miller's black and white comedy special from the early 90s, where he was like,
yeah.
You know, like comedy, like painting fame. Like, can you imagine Jack Nicholson as a produce clerk in a grocery store? Nah, fuck you. You, I see as a produce clerk in a grocery store.
Yeah.
Let's not take America's highest paid actor and have him spritzing turnips for $3.35 an hour.
Here's Quinn.
Here's five references I don't understand.
Yeah, Dana once reduced Dennis's act to topic, indifference, reference. Or maybe it was topic, reference, indifference.
What am I, Kerba Kabuka?
Yeah.
I think,
the pulp? What's with that hat?
I think... was it Dom Irrera told me once that he was like, yeah, I would see him at the improv sometimes and I would slip in some fake words and just see what he would do and he would agree with me. Like, you know, it was pretty canacious. Yeah, pretty canacious.
Yeah, I was pretty canacious there, Dommy.
Oh, I love him.
San Francisco, by the way, is still a phenomenal.
Yes. Well, you know, since. The more generations keep coming out, Patton Oswalt and Paula Tompkins, people spent time there.
They spent time there, your Brian Posehn's and
yeah.
your Doug Benson's and Sarah's and Tom Kenny. It was a good. I think San Francisco's you don't want to stay there forever.
Well, that's the thing, you know.
Because you can get comfortable.
Being raised in Northern California, God, it was one of my first bits 100 years ago. We were trained. To hate Los Angeles
mm-hmm.
because of the sellout factor.
Okay.
That was the only reason to go there. Was money, the pursuit of money. Mm-hmm. If you're an artist, you stay in San Francisco. And when you're very young, it's like when you're 5 at school. All right, kids, there's reading, arithmetic, history, LA sucks. One more time.
I think Paul F. Tompkins pointed out, this one-sided war? Oh,
by the way, I thought when I got here, you guys hated us too. Turns out, everything north of Santa Barbara, you think the world drops off.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's not... I mean, listen, it's only because we're focused too much on ourselves here
yeah.
to have a battle with any other city.
Yeah, there's no acknowledgement.
Yeah.
At all.
Right.
It's like, oh, you. and yet, it was... The idea was to rise to the top as quickly as possible and get the fuck out.
Mm-hmm.
And I got there in 78, and by 83 I'd moved here
mm-hmm.
To Los Angeles. And then, you know, it was just hundreds of auditions where it wasn't just a matter of no, it was how about anyone but you was going to get this? and that's how you learn, literally, for me anyways. And people, you know, comedians were... Hey, you got to get into this acting class. I'm like, wait, really? I hate school. Let's start there. Did I mention I hate school? And
so,
then who's teaching me acting? A guy who's a guest star on
right.
Bewitched? What am I? What? What?
I would have taken that class. A guy who's guest star. Was it Paul Lind? If it was Paul Lind, I'm in.
Yeah, that would be recurring.
Okay. All right. No, here. Not a guest star.
Did he get top of show?
No.
Well,
no,
these phrases.
Shit.
So, yeah.
I want to know...
That's how I just let it go.
Oh, yeah. What were we talking about? You're trailing off. It's hypnotized me. I did your show, the Kevin Pollak Chat Show.
Sir.
I guess, what was it, last year now? God dang. It's been a while. Anyway.
Earlier part of this year.
It was so much fun. And I love that you, like, what made you decide to, I just feel like you still sort of legitimized the idea of podcasting a video podcast. Like, you know, you're a famous guy, and you decided to embrace the internet.
The higher the profile in traditional media, I suppose, the bigger impact you have on new media. Yeah, it makes sense. I don't know if you listen to Radio Classics on your XM or Sirius, whatever it is.
I've not. There's so many stations I haven't gone near.
The Radio Classics, you know, it's Jack Benny's show. It's all these great radio shows. Orson Welles, you know. Anyways, I imagine those guys who came from radio being nudged about television.
Mm-hmm.
And
who's gonna watch it?
Yeah, I mean, it really is. It seemed like that to me in terms of the internet about 2 years ago. Because up until then, Jimmy Pardo had been doing his, and there were certainly a few others from my world, from the stand-up world, who had embraced it. But I hadn't seen that many from who had a real profile, per se, in traditional media. Lisa Kudrow, I think, was doing the web therapy.
I think she always made great choices outside of Friends.
I wish the rest of America agreed. Because all of her stuff that she's done has been great. And no,
you know,
one watched
I feel like she was the only one on that show that didn't let their agent talk them into, you're gonna be the face of this movie, and you're gonna, like, no matter what the movie is, like, she took really cool roles in, like, The Opposite of Sex, she took roles in really cool things, and I loved the comeback.
Yeah,
I thought the comeback was fucking awesome.
Sarah Silverman last night, we were performing at some benefit, and she said that the comeback is indeed coming back. Someone has picked it up on one of your smaller cable outlets.
Excellent news.
Yeah.
So back to your show.
It was an idea of, I went to visit the internet mini mogul jerk Jason Calacanis at the home of Mahalo.com, and I walked into his studio, this little tiny studio at the edge of his big offices. I said, what the hell is this? He said, well, one of my worker drones does This Week in YouTube in here. So we put up some lights and built them a little thing. And I, before I could stop the words from coming out of my face, I was saying, I think I want to do a Charlie Rose with a Sense of Humor from here. I mean, I hadn't thought of those words in that order once in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Not once. I don't know where this thought came from. And he said, unfortunately for me, how soon can you start? And my sphincter tightened. I went, whoa, whoa, I didn't, what, oh, let me call, let's see if I can get some guests. And within a couple of months, I put together, I mean, the infrastructure was kind of there already, you know, there was a TriCaster, you know, there were monitors.
It is a very professional setup. Like, when I went to do Kevin's show, there was a makeup person.
So it's the opposite of this?
It is the opposite, the diametrical opposite to the Nerdist podcast. There's a crew, you guys.
You don't win the Streamy Award for best live show.
Fucking Streamies! Word, I just, my sphincter tightens up. Mainly because I almost got raped at the Streamies by a guy who jumped on stage.
I think you're past almost.
I thought he was jamming his finger into my pants, and then when I watched the video, I was like, his pants are down. That was a boner. Okay, all right. Got some stuff to work out, but I'm fine with it. But I saw you backstage, like, right before you went out for the Streamies, and I think we high-fived, like, Streamies! We have made it, my friend.
Yeah. It's still stripped down and it's been way more enjoyable than I ever thought it would be.
Mm-hmm.
And creatively, the internet is nirvana, because we talked about how the studios and the network are able to add water. And I think they add water to to greatness at a genius level. I think they have a savant ability to find the epicenter of the thing that makes the piece great, and that's where they add the water. They don't just sprinkle all the way around trying to dilute the whole thing.
Well, sure, because when things are different and unique and original, they can't compare it to anything.
Yeah.
Because they think in terms of charts and demographics, and
sure.
And you can't, it is impossible to quantify the idea from a marketing standpoint of, let's just let funny people be funny. Like, they can't, there has to be a reason. It has to be because that guy has a beard. It's a beard!
Yeah, and boy, you know, it's exploding on cable now. AMC being born of Mad Men, Breaking Bad, and now Walking Dead. And, you know, you see shows branding a network like that. So that's happening. And at the same time, there is even more freedom, actually, on the internet to do, as I just pointed out, walking into a little studio and saying, yeah, let's do a fucking show. See what happens. And here we are, a year and a half later, and...
P.S. with Google TV, you have a television talk show.
Well, we were instantly on TiVo, and then people who had Rokus and a couple of other boxes could, in fact, pull us up. And along with Google TV, you know, there's a new Samsung flat screen that has internet built into the remote.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the game changer, when it's in the remote. Now you're on the same menu as every cable and network. And so when I started a year and a half ago, those conversations were taking place. You know, we're a year away from ... And it only took a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And the internet's in the remote. So I felt like, not since my stand-up days, of those heady days of the late 70s, early 80s in San Francisco, did I feel like I was a part of something incredible, like I do working online in the last year and a half. Honestly,
it is. It's an amazing time. Like just all the comics that you've seen who've discovered, oh, I can be myself and do my own thing that no one can get their fingers on, and get my voice out there and connect with people in a way that on a very substantial level. I mean, like when you look at the numbers of people who are downloading podcasts, like they are incredibly respectable numbers.
No, we're upwards of 700,000 a month, and everything's relative. You know, there are others with considerably more. But what boggles my mind is just that we just threw it out there.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, coming from traditional media, when we started, I said to the internet mini mogul jerk Jason Calacanis' partner, I got to hire a publicist. This is what happens when you launch something. I have to hire a publicist.
He probably told you not to do that.
He said, you can't do that. He said, YouTube kicked Oprah off in 36 hours. You don't tell them you're there. You just show up.
He's a smart guy.
It's the ultimate, if you build it, they will come.
Well, not only that, but I think it's also fun for people to be like...
Discovery.
It gives them the ability, because people like sharing things, it gives them the ability to tell other people, have you seen this thing?
Yeah.
You know?
I've been a part of that in as an actor in films. It's hard to fathom, but The Usual Suspects opened on 300 screens.
I have heard of that movie.
Never went wider than 800 screens and made a scant $22 million total at the domestic box office. It's hard to fathom those low numbers in terms of the worldwide success of that little movie that was shot for $5 million.
Mm-hmm.
So that was all about discovery. To this day, it's about discovery. I have 20-year-olds coming to my shows because if you're a sophomore in college to this day and you can't speak suspects, you're a fucking loser. It regenerates almost every year a new demographic. So there you go. Discovery. It turning somebody on to it. You know, you haven't seen this? I mean, how many people take possession of a show like Breaking Bad?
Right.
It's hilarious the way they turn you on to it. You're not watching Breaking Bad? Oh, man.
You're a fucking dick.
Oh, yeah.
You're worse than Mussolini. What? I just haven't seen the show.
I haven't killed.
Yeah. Well, so what do you see as the future of, because, you know, like I think it's great that we're all sort of, and you know, an argument could be made, we're not really the first wave of podcasting. I mean, like the first wave of podcasting really happened like, you know,
five, six years ago. Yeah.
But I still feel like we're kind of on the ground floor, and you know, are we going to be the ones that figure out how to take it to the next level, or is it going to be the second wave that looks at, you know, like,
well, it is.
Are we building the platform?
It is figuring itself out.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about discovery not being able to force the issue. The audience builds to a number that has to be acknowledged by more powerful entities.
At some point,
that's
yeah.
basically what happens. That's why web therapy is going to Showtime. That's why Children's Hospital went to Adult Swim. Mm-hmm. That's why Doug Benson's Interruption, which played as a podcast for a while, didn't it?
Yeah. He did I Love Movies. He never podcasted Interruption.
So, two out of three examples. but...
Ricky Gervais' podcast is cut up and now on HBO as a cartoon.
But you and I had this conversation off the air. And I've been talking about it on my show a little bit. I did sit down at the potential possibility of this backfiring. I did sit down with the Young Turks at iTunes podcast mm-hmm. and say, you know, you have to allow us to charge 99 cents a show. And they said, well, you know, I said, first of all, let me start the conversation by saying I can't believe Steve Jobs is missing an opportunity to make money. That blows everyone's mind.
Right.
Free is great. Free is fantastic. You've built up thousands of podcasts now by offering them free.
Mm-hmm.
But as much as people like the idea of free, they also want their entertainment to have value.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want it to literally be valueless. There's a certain, and I learned this from stand-up comedy, there's a certain subconscious relationship between the audience. And, you know, we used to do a free park, they still do it to this day, a free show in Golden Gate Park called Comedy Celebration Day.
Yeah, that just happened.
Yeah. And
yeah.
40,000 people show up to a free show, and you see all these great comics doing 5-6 minutes each, and Robin Williams usually closes the show every year.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great, and it's, like I said, 20 to 40,000 people, depending on the year, would show up for this free show. But then the comedy clubs, where they paid money to go see acts, didn't dry up. They thrive on a nightly basis. And the audience, at some point, as I explained to the podcast guys, I said, let me liken it literally to stand-up comedy. When you first start, you get on stage, and if you're any good, you can earn an audience. If you can sustain quality on stage as a performer, people will start talking about you and coming out to see you on a different night.
Mm-hmm.
You will earn an audience. And if you can earn an audience and sustain that, you can earn a living.
Right.
Those are the rules. And so I said to them, you're now not allowing us to make a living. And we've earned an audience. And so we are at the precedent setting moment in history in terms of iTunes podcasts. Our show, I will break this officially, I suppose. I don't know when this is going to air, so the switch may have been thrown just prior to this airing. But we're, so I'm told, a week away from flipping the switch and offering 2-3 minute previews of every show for free, offering a half dozen full episodes for free, and then it's 99 cents. And by the way, for 2 hours, in many cases?
Right.
99 cents?
Yeah.
That, to me, is the magic number.
It's interesting, because a lot of the different comics doing podcasts, or I guess just podcasts in general, there's so many different models that people are experimenting with. Like, Pardo has a subscription-based
yeah.
model, and Marin has, I think, a donation-based model. And, you know, so it'll be interesting if people can start charging. I
may be back on your show in 6 weeks saying, can you believe that I was charging?
What a disaster.
Yeah.
And then we're in a different house that actually has a real skeleton.
We're in the guest house.
Police tape around it. But for me, I probably, for this show, I don't see myself charging necessarily for it. If we expanded to a video format,
right.
we would have to, because... It's just like, it just costs money. I mean, yeah. I said to people before, like, I'm not ever trying to bilk. I don't look at the audience and go like, yeah, I just see a lot of dollar signs. But at a certain point, I think people understand it costs money to give away stuff.
Yeah, I have a crew.
It costs money to make. You have a whole crew, and you have video and editing.
I have a crew that, well, no editing, because which is kind of great. But I have a crew that I've been paying out of pocket now for almost 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Gladly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to pay them. They all work on other...
Yeah, you don't have to pay them. Look at this guy, Matt Meyer.
Hey, what's up?
Never earned a dime.
Yeah, you don't...
That's why that second deductible really hurts Progressive.
Yeah, and by the way, it's on all of their resumes. It's on all of their resumes, and they work on other internet shows for free. And I made it clear to them that I would pay them on a weekly basis. And if the show were to earn money on a larger scale, they're cut in to that back end. And in fact, this Apple iTunes experiment that's going down momentarily, they're going to own a piece of that.
I can't wait to sit on the sidelines and watch how that works for you. But
which part?
Paying
my crew?
No. That part's great. I think I still don't feel as bad as I should feel for not paying you and Jonah. But I would love to see. You know, I would love to see just the paradigm shift and see. You know, see if
well,
it's something.
Well, I said to the podcast guys, I'm not. This my first effort at, and the little audio thing I record at the end of the 2-3 minute preview, I had to record something saying, you know, that preview was pretty great, wasn't it? If you want to see the entire 2 hours, all you have to do is on the home page there, it says links, and underneath it says full episode. Just click on that and you're on your way. And the reason that I'm asking you to do this is that, you know, I need my crew to act like it matters.
Mm-hmm.
And you can feed a starving podcast crew by you know, coughing up 99 cents.
It's like, reminds me, I love that part, I love that scene at the end of High Fidelity where Cusack's character, like, tells those young kids, like, all right, we're gonna, you know, you're gonna, I wanna be a label for you. And they're like, man, you're just gonna get yourself a big fat Mercedes. And he's like, we're not there yet. You know, like,
yeah.
And I think hopefully in your case, the audience understands, like, hey, I'm not trying to fuck you guys out of money. I'm just trying to deliver a consistent quality product.
Not only that, I want to expand it. You know, Calcanis and I built now this internet network, thisweekend.com, and we have like 16 shows. We held open casting and said, do you want to host your own show? And somebody came in with
an idea of
This Week in Movies and This Week in Music and This Week in, you know, video games and expanded into This Week in Mad Men, which Jamie, Mrs. Macabre, 2010, hosts along with a few other people. And then when that series went on hiatus, they started doing This Week in Walking Dead. And
do they iron out the stuff of the old court?
I like that those audiences cross over.
No.
Mad Men and Walking Dead.
It's not, rarely the same audience, but
I would love to see Mad Men, and they're literally mad with zombieism.
Sure. Yeah, right?
That's how that would work.
To the madness.
Let's walk through it.
Yeah. But
Joni, I love to eat your pussy. Literally!
So, the last thing I said to the podcast guys...
I hate myself.
No, don't. You gotta bring the funny, because I've been yammering.
All I did was say the word pussy.
No.
It's really always funny.
No. Yeah. Not always. You have to get creative.
And your bottle of 1960 scotch, who's dressed like a fox, is staring at me. His arms are behind
his
back.
The fox
just looks disapproving.
Like a hunter.
Oh no, Chris
Hardwick.
That's
Hardwick. Not the look of disapproval.
I'm a fox with a waistcoat and a top hat. I did better. So can you. That's what I feel like he's saying to me.
Yeah. No wonder you're not charging. But I did say to the Apple guys, I said, you know, there's guys in line behind me, by the way. This isn't just me looking out for me. I'm actually trying to form a union, and you just don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want people to leave the framework of iTunes, and you shouldn't either. The subscription model and all these other models, I can do that. But I think I'd rather just stay here at the iTunes.
Yeah, I would think they would want people to not go off-site, you know, if they had the ability to profit from that. But I don't know. We'll see. I mean,
will see. And I look forward to coming back and talking about it.
I can't wait for this.
I would love to. You should come back on in, you know, like 4 or 5 months, you know, like after it's kind of, you'll get a good picture at that point.
Oh, absolutely. I expect, you know, you have various numbers in mind in terms of what you're going to hold on to. And to me, I don't want to alienate, because people email all the time
yeah.
and tweet all the time. oh, I just discovered your show, do a thing, and I really fucking dig it.
Yeah, I see
just
that.
Watched a whole episode of Paul of Tompkins, holy fuck. Mm-hmm. And that's a, that has been its own reward and will continue to be its own reward. And the idea of alienating anyone is what you want to avoid, mm-hmm. which is why you're having trepidation yourself and may most likely continue to.
Yeah, because my main goal is just to get to as many people as possible so that people will come out and see live shows.
Right.
And what we talked about before is if we ever charge for anything on the show, it would have to be like it'd have to be an extra thing, like we're doing a video podcast, or right. you know, like maybe at some point the live shows that we do sometimes at Largo become a bonus episode each month.
Right.
And we charge for that just so that I can pay people who come on as if it were an actual talk show.
Well, that is the other thing, you know, to, by the way, as I said, not just I want to take care of my crew, but to build out a more substantial type of show mm-hmm. that you would get from cable or television. And at 99 cents, by the way, again, you know, the raping and the bilking of your audience at 99 cents is right. hysterical to me.
Well, it'll become interesting if...
You can get a song for 3 minutes.
For nine, yeah.
$1.29 Same price usually. I'm offering
two hours. So...
It'll be... But what will be interesting is to see where people start to fall when... You know, when a bunch of podcasts that they like start charging, and then it's like, oh, you know, then $5 a month becomes like $30
well,
a month.
Well, I brought this up because you asked, where are we going? Where is it leading?
Yeah.
Are we the generation that dot, or is it the one behind us? So I'm making the first step into the shit.
And I want to tell you that I appreciate that.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. The audience, it may be just a resounding go fuck yourself.
Right.
You know, or we may be sitting here 6 months from now. And you're on my independent music label at Apple because that's the only way to get in now.
And this table will be made of gold.
Right. No, I don't. I envision building out the thisweekend.com network and having a bigger studio. And
his talk show desk will be made of gold.
That would be nice.
Yeah. I'll know that for sure.
Yeah, of course.
I want mine to be made of Black American Express card.
Exactly.
That I bought with a Black American Express card. Well, Kevin Pollak, we've come to the end of our hour, but I think it's just fantastic that you know, as a legitimate performer, you're kind of taking a step back and really taking this medium seriously. And I mean, I think it is a wildly valuable medium that most of the entertainment business sort of overlooks because, like, podcasting, have fun in your mom's basement. It's like, no, this. This is these are getting substantial numbers and they're reaching a substantial number of people, like more in a, I mean, like probably like the early days of radio, you know.
Right.
But now people have a choice to connect with the content that they want, and I'm fascinated by your process with all this, and I really hope it works out. I really do, and I wanna talk to you again about it in a few months.
I look forward to it, and I hope you can come back and be on the Kevin Pollak chat show.
I'll come on whenever. I will happily come back on.
Because I do take great joy in having not just comedians on, but comedians that represent a different generation than my own. Because I've had people like Kevin Nealon on, mm-hmm. people of my own generation, and that's its own joy for me. But I will return the compliment saying I'm a huge fan.
Oh, that's so sweet. Well, I will come back on anytime you have time. I love me some Sam Levine too.
Right?
Sam Levine is the best.
Sweet Sammy.
So we gotta get Sam on the podcast too at some point.
Well, he read our ad for all.
Yeah, but he needs his own episode. He deserves his own episode. That's long overdue. We'll rectify that, Sammy. Kevin Pollak, thank you so much. Matt Myra, thank you for being here.
Maybe next time I'll have a car.
Jonah Ray had to work. I hope you have a car. I hope Progressive Insurance doesn't continue to tear extra assholes into your body and fuck them.
I like your rates, but I hate your policies.
That is kind of a negative way to end the podcast.
How about if it were 99 cents a show, you could get yourself a car?
That would be amazing.
No, what are you saying?
No,
that wouldn't help him at all.
No,
you're saying he wouldn't get any of that.
I think Kevin might be onto something here, Chris.
He wouldn't get any of that.
We may have a position for you at thisweekend.com.
It is important to keep them down under your foot on their neck.
I have headphones on, Chris.
It's horrible.
Did you hear?
I heard all of that.
That's the only way he could hear you.
Enjoy your burrito, America. Enjoy your burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.
I have missed these Friday night dinners.
Hey, welcome to Harvey Graw!
At these family dinners...
Gracious, everyone!
Dysfunction is served.
I can't have you all messing things up for my entire adult life.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do we embarrass you?
Jump, jump, jump!
It's already better than I dared to dream.
They're extra.
Let the wild rumpus start!
Woo, 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 woo.
And they're embarrassing.
We know how hard it is to move on from the first girl that you ever slept with.
Not the first girl who I ever slept
with. Yeah, right. You're a regular lady killer.
I thought you said it was going to be boring here tonight.
No!
I really hoped it would be.
But they couldn't love each other more.
Surprise! To mom and dad being totally normal.
Wow.
So, dinner next Friday, everyone?
Wouldn't miss it for the world.
Dinner with the Parents, Season 1. Stream free only on Freevee.